The following is a recording of P.J. Crowley presenting American Foreign Policy in a Time of Fractured Politics and Failed States on October 6, 2017.
Ms. Joan LeMoyne will introduce our speaker.
Good morning. As a former educator, this time of year was always exciting, the start of a new academic year. And like any academic institution, we always had new students that we welcomed each fall. And Maureen tells me we have over 100 new members. I don't know how many of you are here today, but if you're a new member, would you stand so we can welcome you to this organization? Thank you. We're glad you found time to join us. Foreign policy in a time of changing world order is our theme for this speaker program. As students of foreign policy, this council gives its members many opportunities to dig deeper into the issues with our Great Decisions discussion program, our fall forum, our summer forum, our evening speaker series. If you're participating in the fall forum, you're now studying world order from the perspective of Dr. Henry Kissinger. Today, we're beginning our series with a speaker who has recently authored The Red Line, on sale in the lobby after the program. One reviewer said, "It's a sweeping and densely packed account of American-centric diplomacy and warfare, and how the government has been trying to find a balance between the U.S. as a global police officer and as a more modest presence." After receiving his bachelor's degree from Holy Cross, P.J. Crowley joined the Air Force and served our country for 26 years. In 1997, he was named Senior Director of Public Affairs for the United States National Security Council and Special Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. He served under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Since leaving that position, he's taught at the U.S. Army War College, Dickinson College, and Penn State as the General Omar Bradley Chair in Strategic Leadership. He currently teaches at the George Washington University in the Institute for Public Diplomacy and Global Communication. Please welcome back to our lectern, P.J. Crowley.
Can you hear me all right? All right. I don't know that this is necessary. Thank you very, very much for coming. I'm happy to be back at Hilton Head. It was 4 years since I was last here, and I'm so glad that nothing has changed in the meantime. But this is a great place to speak. My first impulse is to start my remarks by saying, let us pray. Depending on your political persuasion of the last 9 months, you've probably said that a lot. But I am absolutely honored to kick off the 2017-2018 speaker series. I'm not quite sure what to do with that. I never had any luck. I played Hilton Head yesterday afternoon, had no luck stopping that ball either. So I'll just put it there. Thanks, Claudia. So let me stipulate up front that I've lived in Washington for 30 of the past 33 years, both in government and a think tank at a university. So I admit it. I am a card-carrying member of the foreign policy establishment, and that makes me, to paraphrase the President of the United States, a swamp creature. But today I hope to kind of play the role of Tony Romo, who I guess is the new football analyst on CBS. If you're watching on Sundays, past the pregame and whether the players kneeled or didn't kneel and so forth. You know, Tony goes through X's and O's and arrows to describe plays and why, either why they worked or why they didn't. So I'd like to help us all understand, you know, the foreign policy game as it is currently being played. And, you know, although unlike football, there is not an obvious and immediate reward system in place. You know, there are no first downs to tell you that you are making progress. There's no scoreboard that tells you you are winning. But in Washington, there are a lot of punts these days. Yeah, you know, we heard news of last night where the president seems poised to kick the Iran deal over to the Congress, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Get out the telestrator and see how that play is likely to unfold. But from the sidelines, you know, those of us who have served both Democratic and Republican administrations are trying to decipher, you know, where the collection of actions, words, and tweets over the last 9 months, what that means in terms of the Trump foreign policy and what it adds up to. You know, as we know, President Trump is an improvisational actor. He talks often about the importance he attaches to unpredictability. Well, he has been successful in that pursuit. But in many respects, he is actually very predictable. He is doing exactly what he said he would do if elected. So did Barack Obama. As George W. Bush once said, elections matter. Now, there has been an incredible amount of turmoil in these 9 months. Aides departing, including the National Security Advisor, aides changing jobs, including the Secretary of Homeland Security, and aides staying, including one, the Secretary of State, who called an unusual press conference to announce that he is staying on the job. Now, in my experience, anytime you call in the press to say you didn't do this or say that, there's a problem. The secretary assured us that he didn't threaten to resign and he didn't call his boss a moron. Now, there is significant tension and frustration in that relationship. The secretary talked about helping the president achieve more victories going forward, but in most of the major decisions made thus far, withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, and if the reports are correct, not certifying Iran as in compliance with the JCPOA, or the Iran deal as we colloquially call it, the secretary has been at odds with presidential statements and presidential tweets. You know, we'll talk about North Korea in a minute. But to me, the most telling comment the secretary made was what he said about Washington. I am not from this place. Which is to say that even though he came to the job with an impressive international resume, he is uncomfortable with the public give and take of the political process. Yet in the modern era, these public and political dimensions of being Secretary of State have become central to an effective foreign policy voice at home and abroad. George Shultz, Jim Baker, Warren Christopher, Madeleine Albright, Colin Powell, Condi Rice, Hillary Clinton, and John Kerry understood Washington, how to navigate around its water hazards and its bunkers, and how to function in the unique lair that involves, you know, the nation's capital. Prediction number one. It is more likely than not that when you launch your speaker series a year from now, your former governor, Nikki Haley, will be the Secretary of State. Write that down. If I'm right, you can invite me back. If I'm wrong, what does he know? Now, a major factor hampering the Secretary of State is the lack of a complete national security and foreign policy team, the absence of undersecretaries and assistant secretaries that provide depth to our foreign policy and help our country clearly articulate what the United States wants to accomplish to allies and adversaries around the world. A major factor in the early momentum 8 years ago was the deal that the president and Hillary Clinton made where she could form her own policy team at the State Department. I was part of that package, a small part. You know, but within 6 months, policy reviews had been conducted. The president had given two detailed and far-reaching foreign policy addresses. The secretary herself had given one. 8 years ago this month, the United States made a very significant proposal to Iran regarding its nuclear program, the first in a lengthy series of negotiations that culminated in the Iran nuclear deal. There was a lot going on, a strategy in place, a negotiating team at work, a process underway, and decisive international support. While Iran is returning to the headlines, the Trump administration foreign policy legacy is most likely going to revolve around what happens with North Korea. To his credit, the president deserves an enormous amount of credit for building significant international support, particularly with China, behind increased sanctions, but it is unclear if there is a realistic path forward. As Kim Jong-un intensified progress towards an actual nuclear deterrent, he has engaged in a war of words with the President of the United States, with Mr. Trump coining the term Little Rocket Man, and Kim returning fire, you know, calling the President a deranged dotard, which sent us all to the dictionary to fully understand the meaning of this medieval term. Now, bombastic rhetoric has long been a North Korean staple. You know, what is new is the president with an itchy Twitter finger who talks about options that are locked and loaded to deliver fire and fury if the United States is not just attacked, but is threatened. And that was a couple of missile launches and a nuclear test ago. There was an interesting story in the Washington Post the other day highlighting how North Korean officials are reaching out to former U.S. officials who worked particularly under Republican presidents for help in trying to understand Donald Trump. They are obviously not alone. What I found striking about the Post story was the comment by one former official who has participated in what we call Track 2 dialogue, unofficial conversations between, you know, North Korean officials and U.S. officials. He said that the North Koreans displayed an encyclopedic knowledge of every Trump tweet. Now, it's easy for us to say that his next tweet is just Trump being Trump. But they form an unprecedented window into what the President of the United States actually thinks, if not always, what he will actually do. In unprecedented ways, he is incredibly transparent and unfiltered. Now, that carries authenticity that clearly appealed to many American voters, but there are serious consequences when his communications are made impulsively without a clear strategic purpose. One of his recent tweets, where he suggested that talks with North Korea are a waste of time, undermined his Secretary of State, who had acknowledged that the United States was probing existing channels of communication to see if we could launch a dialogue with Pyongyang. Now, as discomforting as that was for Secretary Tillerson, more significantly, the President's tweet perhaps narrowed the policy options available to the Trump administration. If there is no diplomatic solution short of North Korean capitulation, it becomes more likely that Pyongyang will achieve a basic nuclear deterrent in the coming months, leaving the United States and its allies with a stark choice: eliminate the threat through military force or live with it. In fairness to the Trump administration, it confronts questions that previous administrations didn't. Up until now, we have been dealing with nuclear ambitions. Now we have to assume we are dealing with some level of an actual capability, with progress accelerating at an unexpected rate. What is Kim Jong-un trying to do? We don't know for sure. The American with the greatest insight into his thinking is the former basketball star Dennis Rodman. Seriously. Now, you know, Dennis says, not to worry. It is likely that young Kim sees nuclear weapons as a regime insurance policy. If so, he has already achieved that goal. Both the Secretaries of Defense and State have stressed that we do not have a policy of regime change. From Kim's standpoint, Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi did not have nuclear weapons and did not survive. He is not likely to give them up voluntarily. What does this mean for regional security? Some friends of mine who have worked this issue believe he will try to drive a wedge between the United States and South Korea, which makes it curious why the president, in the midst of this current crisis, thought it was the right time to threaten to terminate the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement. Now, notwithstanding the president's ambivalence about security alliances, we need to make clear to North Korea that we are not leaving the region. We will defend North Korea, we will defend Japan, our key regional allies. You know, but that said, to a large extent, our policy is out of date. Kim is not interested in the grand bargain that the international community has offered for the past two decades, normalization in return for denuclearization. President Trump has been right to put a greater burden on China, not just to support sharper sanctions, but to take responsibility for managing its client state. Can we live with and deter North Korea? I believe we can. As Steve Bannon acknowledged in his exit interview at the White House, there is no military option that doesn't place thousands and thousands of Korean, Japanese, and American citizens at risk. I suspect we'll talk about that a little bit during the Q&A. But notwithstanding the president's rhetoric, his options in North Korea, and Syria for that matter, are tempered by the politics of the moment. Not only are Americans today increasingly skeptical of an interventionist foreign policy, but President Trump clearly shared that skepticism on the campaign trail, as he made clear on a number of occasions, including his inaugural address. He was elected leader of the United States, not the world. Now, from Truman to Obama, presidents have accepted the idea that the occupant of the Oval Office was concurrently the leader of the free world. Donald Trump is the first in modern time to say he does not want that responsibility. Perhaps more overtly than we have ever seen, politics is profoundly shaping foreign policy today. Now, at one level, there's nothing new about this. You know, in the run-up to World War II, FDR was careful not to get too far ahead of the isolationist sentiment that significantly restricted his options until Pearl Harbor. Lyndon Johnson carefully weighed what he felt he needed to accomplish in Vietnam against his ambitions for the great society. Of course, he also did not believe he could abandon Vietnam in light of the powerful political narrative of who lost China that handicapped Harry Truman. President George H.W. Bush thought Ronald Reagan's signature moment, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall, was a mistake, even though Reagan intended it to create room for Gorbachev to reform. Of course, Reagan was right. Gorbachev wanted to change the Soviet Union, and in the process, he destroyed it. But President Bush did brilliantly manage the transition to what we thought would be a new world order. But he was cautious initially. He gave a far different speech than Reagan in Ukraine in 1991, in which he cautioned against, quote-unquote, suicidal nationalism, as Ukraine contemplated withdrawal from the Soviet Union. That phrase resonates as we contemplate the implications of Brexit, but as information, technology, and politics have gone global, the foreign policy establishment has struggled to keep up with the increased dynamism of the international environment. Over 30 years, many of my colleagues argued that politics should not intrude into the White House Situation Room. Of course, if you know the layout of the White House, you come in from the side entrance, walk about five steps, turn right, walk down four steps, turn right, you're in the Situation Room. The Situation Room is actually more like four rooms than one. But it's crazy to think that where it was, since the White House is the campus where politics and policy intersect, that somehow you can have a vaccine or an immunization that prevents politics from being part of someone's calculation. My colleagues repeated Arthur Vandenberg's dictum that politics should stop at the water's edge. Well, tell that to Vladimir Putin. I viewed this as a critical blind spot in our understanding of our own country, the impact that elections and political mandates have on foreign policy, what a president wants to achieve in office, and what he believes his people will support. I mean, there's an irony in this. The State Department spends a great deal of effort to understand the politics of other countries and how those politics might affect relations with the United States. Arab public opinion upended the status quo during what we thought was an Arab Spring. And even though that flame is alive, still, barely, in a country like Tunisia, the ripple effects from 2011 are still churning from Morocco to Saudi Arabia. Of course, politics influences foreign policy. Public opinion impacts today's international environment like never before. Last year, the Brexit referendum instantly changed British foreign policy. This year, two recent referenda, both disputed, could alter the boundaries of Iraq and Spain. Scotland continues to mull whether Britain will be greater or lesser. I didn't write Red Line with Donald Trump in mind, but his election reinforces its central premise that you cannot understand American foreign policy today without understanding American domestic politics today. Trump's rhetoric is sharper than Obama's, but he is subject to the same political boundaries that shaped Obama's policy choices. I did write the book to try to put Obama's foreign policy and the strategic narratives that he employed in both a historical and a political context. Again, Obama largely delivered the foreign policy that he advertised and for which he was elected in 2008. Back 8 years ago, the American people were concerned about the rising costs of the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They elected a candidate who promised to reset relations with America's allies, constructively engage America's adversaries, wind down America's wars, and avoid getting more deeply involved in future Middle East conflicts. Obama's foreign policy had consequential successes and failures. In my view, the two bookends were the nuclear agreement with Iran and his hesitation regarding a military response to Syria's use of chemical weapons in 2013. Hence, Red Line. Obama struggled to balance his caution regarding Syria, rooted in his political mandate, with the expansive strategic narrative of American indispensability. Now, I am a supporter of the Iran deal. It didn't solve all the issues that surround Iran, its support of terrorism, its expansive regional ambitions, but it solved one problem for a lengthy period of time. The Trump administration seems to hold the opposite view. Nikki Haley recently outlined the case against the Iran deal. At the risk of oversimplification, it boils down to being a bad deal because it failed to solve all of the problems associated with Iran. Make no mistake, those concerns are real. Its hardline views towards Israel, its support of terrorism, its malign role in the region, most recently its blind support for the Assad regime in Syria. As Secretary of Defense Mattis suggested in recent testimony, that all that said, it is still better to confront a non-nuclear Iran in the region than the alternative. Now, assuming the president refuses to certify that Iran is in compliance with the JCPOA, the issue moves to Congress. The certification process is not part of the JCPOA. It's part of a bill that Congress passed in light of the JCPOA. Now, hopefully, a Congress that is not capable of making consequential decisions these days will be unable or unwilling to scuttle the deal. All right, that's prediction number two. The Trump administration wants to renegotiate a better deal, but there is no willingness by the other parties of what's called the 6+1 process, China, Russia, France, Germany, Britain, the EU, and Iran, to do that. It is thus a decision that has political resonance, but at least for the moment, probably limited real impact, though it will erode American global leadership. Why is the president going to refuse to certify the Iran deal? Well, he campaigned against it, calling it the worst deal ever. Now, politics are not always so determinative. Think back to the 2000 election. George W. Bush actually projected a reasonably conservative foreign policy. It was Al Gore who was the interventionist. But the political boundaries established in the 2000 election evaporated after September 11. President Bush had complete freedom to define an expansive global war on terror and develop a strategy around that compelling narrative. The world was either with us or against us. Now, in my line of work, words matter. When President Bush addressed the American people 16 years ago last month, he said, "We will make no distinction between the terrorists who committed these attacks and those who harbor them." Those 17 words illuminated that path that led the United States from Afghanistan to Iraq. The perceived overreach in Iraq shaped the 2008 election in profound ways. Senators Clinton and McCain voted for the resolution that authorized the intervention in Iraq. Obama, as a state senator, had consistently opposed it. Now, over 8 years, President Obama could not end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he made them more sustainable. He reached the nuclear agreement with Iran. He transformed our relationship with Burma and Cuba, although we've taken a back step here over the last few weeks. He expressed a desire to reestablish common cause with the international community. Europe gave him a Nobel Prize, largely based on his proposed agenda, not his actual accomplishments. Obama was certainly an internationalist, but he was not an interventionist, at least not with the overt use of ground military forces. He used special operations forces, he employed drones, he did not place combat divisions in the middle of intractable conflicts that he did not believe the United States could solve. And this certainly reflects his caution regarding Syria. The dilemma he confronted on August 31st, 2013, a military imperative, but profound public skepticism, was actually captured in 1984 by Caspar Weinberger in his doctrine that attempted to apply the lessons of Vietnam, but more significantly at the time, the lessons of the U.S. intervention in Lebanon. Weinberger said, in part, that the United States should never go to war without reasonable assurance of support from Congress and the American people. Now, Obama felt that he could obtain the votes in favor of military action in Syria, but in the end, Congress wanted no part of such a tough vote. Now, ironically, Obama made the opposite assessment regarding Libya, believing that Congress was incapable of unifying behind the NATO intervention when it was simultaneously trying to shut down the government over yet another budget dispute. Now, in Libya, Obama moved beyond his political mandate, but limited what the United States would do. That decision, in sharp contrast to the 1990s, was consequential. The Libyan government, or more accurately, governments, are still trying to bring order to the chaos across the country, driven by both extremists and by tribal competition for power. Now, in Syria, Obama eventually defined a mission, the degradation and the defeat of the Islamic State. That definition was consistent with his political mandate. You know, defeat an extremist entity that posed a direct threat to the United States, its interests, and its allies. It was never Obama's intention to solve the Syrian civil war, and in my judgment, it won't be Donald Trump's judgment to do that either. Now, you know, when Trump emerged on the political scene, one of the most startling occurrences happened here in South Carolina. He stood on a debate stage and said Iraq was a big, fat mistake. And those kinds of blunt statements helped propel him to the Republican nomination, you know, and the presidency, and obviously he has not been one to shy away from controversy. More than a few foreign policy experts have believed that his stance on various issues would moderate, you know, both during the transition and during the early stages of his time in office. And as we know, he has not softened his view, even with a fairly conventional national security team around him. But he's never going to get Mexico to pay for the wall, but to a great extent, he has tried to do in office what he said he would do during the 2016 campaign. Again, whether this is the right foreign policy for the time is a separate conversation. Now, there are costs to this redefinition of America's role in the world. You know, President Trump's transactional approach, particularly regarding NATO, has generated considerable uncertainty regarding the United States, what the United States will or will not do should there be a confrontation in the future with a more assertive Russia. Obviously, that perception has been exacerbated by Mr. Trump's mysterious fascination with Vladimir Putin and his restrained criticism of Russia despite its actions in Syria, Ukraine, North Korea, and Afghanistan. Given a clear step back on the part of the president, Xi Jinping, the leader of China, has comfortably assumed the role as the leading defender of the existing international order, including the benefits of global trade and the importance of international agreements, particularly the Paris Agreement. Not long ago, we were encouraging China to be a responsible stakeholder in the international system. It is now plausible for President Xi to give the United States the same advice. At the same time, it would be wrong to suggest that the pillars of Donald Trump's foreign policy came out of nowhere and can be easily reversed in a future election. There is meaningful public sentiment in favor of his hard-edged approach to the world. The political boundaries constructed in 2008, and I believe reinforced in 2016, will guide the president, but it will also restrain him. In Riyadh in May, President Trump called on the region to drive extremists out of their country. Behind this narrative is a view that this is the Islamic world's problem to solve. Remember, he was elected to solve problems in Middle America, not to solve problems in the Middle East. Narratives are more than just words. They reflect how America views its role in the world within the political context of the time. Go back to Obama's struggle in Syria. And his caution based on his political mandate, but against the expansive strategic narrative of American indispensability. It was Obama's view, shared by my former boss, Hillary Clinton, that while no major challenge could be solved by the United States alone, no major global challenge could be solved without meaningful involvement by the United States. But herein lies a political and strategic conundrum. Because of the perceived overreach in Iraq, the United States made itself dispensable in Libya and Syria. Going forward, we have to close the gap between what we say and what we do. The belief in the importance of American power and yet the reluctance to bear the costs of American leadership. The expansive conception of American exceptionalism and yet the skepticism regarding what America can actually achieve in the world or needs to achieve in the Middle East. Now, it's easy to dismiss President Trump's signature narrative, "Make America Great Again," as political rhetoric, but it is more than that. Narratives are a way in which leaders connect policy and politics. They all have meaning and power. The United States as the great Satan, Iran as a rogue nation, Russia as an evil empire, China alternatively as a strategic partner or a strategic competitor, the conception of the war on terror as with us or against us, Obama's counter-narrative of an extended hand. They resonate for a reason. So what should we make of "Make America Great Again," hashtag MAGA? Well, H.R. McMaster, the National Security Advisor, and Gary Cohn, the National Economic Advisor, defined it in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, suggesting that America first does not mean America alone. But they rejected the concept of a global community. Rather, they openly embraced the elemental nature of international affairs as a competition for advantage. Now, they may be right about the renewed competition within the existing international order, represented by, for example, the rise of China. It is certainly true about America's renewed rivalry with Vladimir Putin's Russia and his actions not just to undermine his old nemesis, Hillary Clinton, but to undermine confidence in American democracy and Western civilization. We are still learning details about what Russia did. It will be vitally important to separate what the Senate Intelligence Committee learns and what Robert Mueller learns about the threat to our institutions and separate that from the results of the 2016 election. The president needs to do that as well. Russia has undermined what it means to have an informed citizenry. Unfortunately, Mr. Trump plays into that effort when he labels the mainstream media as enemies of the people. But we can't look at these political imperatives in zero-sum terms. Fixing problems in America and shaping the international environment in ways that promote American interests and values. It doesn't have to be an either-or proposition. We can and need to do both. But if we are to change American foreign policy going forward, we have to change American domestic politics, making a more compelling argument in favor of the global interdependence that has worked to the advantage of the United States broadly, even as it has clearly left pockets of our country behind. You know, in 2013, Vladimir Putin placed an op-ed in the New York Times in which he suggested it is dangerous for any country to consider itself exceptional. I think he's wrong. The United States, given its culture, innovation, inclusion, its economy, the United States is exceptional. It has unrivaled power, both hard and soft, yet the United States is not indispensable. The United States is the only true global power. But in a world of rising powers like China and Russia, micropowers like the Islamic State, and social media that has empowered individuals like never before, there are limits to what the United States can achieve in this world at an affordable and sustainable cost. These are the key lessons that the Trump administration is still wrestling with, understanding what can or needs to be accomplished in support of American national security interests, and understanding how to leverage global support to enhance American power and influence in a world that the president has acknowledged is far more complicated than he understood on the campaign trail. With that, I look forward to a great conversation with all of you.